There's a saying that came from one of the original tree keepers. Tree keeper Jim was the person that taught the course for years and years and years, who is no longer with us. But Jim would say that trees are what we do, but people are why we do it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast, a place to explore the emerging technologies and the practitioners that are building greener, healthier, and smarter communities. I'm your host, Nadine Khala. In this season of the Internet of Nature podcast, we explore the future of urban forestry, together with Planet Geo, a pioneering urban forest software and consulting company. I partnered with Planet Geo because they are at the forefront of trees and technology, helping communities around the world map a greener future. Together, we've chosen 9 key topics facing the future of urban forestry. In today's episode, episode 8, we're diving into how we can ensure the trees that are planted today will still be there in 10, 20, 50, and maybe even 100 years' time. Urban tree mortality statistics are all over the map, but the best estimate we have is that the population half-life is 13 to 20 years. In other words, for every 100 street trees that get planted, only 50 will make it to 13 to 20 years. That's pretty grim, considering how many millions of dollars, time, and resources are funneled into tree planting every single year, something that's only expected to increase in the coming generation. Openlands is one of the oldest metropolitan conservation organizations in the U.S. and the only such group with a regional scope. Openlands has helped protect more than 70,000 acres of natural and open spaces of northeastern Illinois and the surrounding region. They've become famous for their highly successful Tree Planters Grant and Tree Keepers Program, which coordinates tree maintenance and stewardship. So Tom Ebeling, my guest today, is a community arborist and manages both of these programs at Openlands. As it turns out, community outreach and education is key to a healthy tree establishment and may just hold the secret to transforming tree planting campaigns into tree growing campaigns. Now, I know in the past when I've talked about tree establishment, I've really dug into, pun intended, a lot of different technologies that we have at our disposal, whether that be soil sensors, GIS, better planning tools, big data, algorithms, we can help to optimize irrigation, and these tools will all play an important role. But I think when we focus the conversation a little too heavy on technology, we forget about the real importance that these community outreach and education programs can have. And Tom from Openlands is the best person to talk about this. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Tom. Hey, Tom. Welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you on. I think it's also always useful to start with a little bit of an introduction into who my guest is today. So maybe let's just kick us off from the beginning. Who is Tom, and how did you get into trees and urban forestry?
My name is Tom Ebeling. I'm a community arborist for Openlands, which is a Chicago-based nonprofit. I have kind of always had an inherent interest in trees. I have no memory of this incident, but my mom talks about retrieving me out of the top of our neighbor's sweet gum when I was 3 years old. I got like 60 feet up before anybody knew where I had gone. And then they realized I was in the neighbor's tree. And so my mom had to climb up and bring me down. I have always sought refuge is probably not the right word. I had a fantastic childhood, but I was always up in trees. I was always hiding in trees. We did a lot of hiking as a family and spent a lot of time in the woods, camping. I'm from Missouri, and there's a lot of really fantastic woods around the suburb where I grew up. So we used to do a lot of family hiking and stuff like that. I grew up in Boy Scouts. And then in high school and early education, I basically always found myself trying to not be doing schoolwork and being outside doing other things. And then I discovered that forestry was actually a field. I had to explain what forestry was.
You made that your schoolwork.
Yeah, exactly. I had to explain to my high school guidance counselor what forestry was.
Really?
And yeah, I did. And I studied forestry at the University of Missouri. It was an urban forestry program. I was lucky enough to study under some really fantastic professors that were sort of instrumental in the foundation of urban forestry as a field. Yeah, and I guess the other kind of seed of that life is, I mentioned I grew up in the suburbs, spent a lot of time in the woods, but there's a creek behind my house that I spent tons and tons of time in as a kid. And then revisiting that patch of woods as I got older and seeing how particularly there's a really gnarly invasive in that area called bush honeysuckle. I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar, but just watching the way that patch of woods changed from the time that I was a kid until I started my forestry education, and then looking at it through the eyes of a forester was really, really interesting to me. And then just spending a ton of time in parks and all that good stuff. So it started very early on for me.
Yeah, no kidding. It sounds like it at age three, you could say. And who knows, yeah. Maybe even before then, because the one thing that I noticed about that story is that it was, you know, your mom in that story doesn't seem to panic. She just, you know, climbs up that tree herself to come and retrieve you. So I'm thinking maybe this was already started in utero. Some kind of tree love or tree understanding was already there from your mom.
I would certainly agree with that. The way the story goes is that the neighbor was panicking and was about to get the fire department on the phone. And my mom was like, "We're not dealing with that today."
See, there you go. There you go. Just like, not a worry. Yeah. This is definitely my son.
Yeah. Shout out Teresa.
Aw. So you're explaining to your guidance counselor what forestry was, but you decided to go into urban forestry specifically. Why the choice to get into urban forestry?
Because I'm a people person at heart. My favorite thing to do is to talk to people and to kind of dive in on, like, when we started chatting, I wanted to know your story, and that is my first instinct almost always, is to talk to the people that I meet about what they're about and where they came from. And I realized pretty early on in undergrad that I probably didn't belong in the woods marking trees for the logging companies. And I respect the folks that do that, and that's a very necessary part of the economy and of forestry work in general. But I really have always wanted to work with and around people. And I think there is just really tremendous opportunity at that intersection of you know, nature and where people live, and the nature in you know, people's immediate surroundings, I think, has always been really, really interesting to me. And also just the resiliency of nature in the urban environment has always been fascinating to me. You know, trees that grow out of sidewalks, and coyote populations that establish themselves in sewers, and the things that raccoons do, you know, just all of the crazy stuff that happens when the built environment butts up against the natural environment has been really, really fascinating to me.
Yeah, I feel the same, because I always feel like if we can make nature work in cities, you know, we can make it work anywhere. Because this is really, and I think David Nowak has been quoted with saying this, USDA forest researcher, for people who aren't familiar, is this idea of, like, if you could plant any tree anywhere, do it in front of your house, because that tree is going to have the most impact on you, not just, you know, ecologically and economically and all those things, but just from a very human perspective, being able to establish that relationship between nature, which in many places has either been severely disconnected or completely lost, and being able to establish that, especially in this day and age in our modern world, I think is just fascinating. It's not no longer this idea of going back to nature, but how do we move forwards toward nature in the areas that we live is I agree. It's fascinating to not only learn more about it, but actually work in that field as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad you say that. That's one of the main objectives. So if I can, I take a second to talk about open lands.
Please, that was going to be my next question. What does open lands do? Look at that.
Perfect. So open lands is a conservation nonprofit based in Chicago, Illinois. It is a regionally active nonprofit. It's one of the oldest conservation nonprofits in the country. It was founded in 1963. One of the original functions was as a certified land trust, you know, buying land, protecting it in perpetuity, and then passing it on to long-term managers, whether that's Cook County Forest Preserves, U.S. Forest Service, any other, you know, government entity that will, you know, take ownership of that land now that it's protected. And since its inception, it has expanded into all kinds of different community conservation realms. We have, obviously, we still do land preservation. We have an education department that does bird education, gardening stuff. We have a water trails division that focuses on increasing access to the many waterways that we have, specifically in the Chicago region. One of their big projects is the African American Heritage Water Trail, focusing on the Calumet, Little Calumet River in the Calumet region. Really, really important. That could be an entire episode in and of itself. A lot of really important work happening down there around the water trails. And then, of course, we have the forestry division that I work for. And the way that I can say the overarching theme of open lands is connecting people to nature where they live. That is sort of the thing that ties all of our work together.
Hmm.
The other function that we have served historically, basically since the founding of the organization, was as conveners of people. So we have been involved in a lot of different coalitions and bringing people from different, you know, aspects of city government, community organizations, community members. We have spent a lot of time and done a lot of work bringing people together to have conversations around this swath of topics. But again, that increasing access to nature where you live, where people currently are, and like you were talking about the Dr. Nowak quote, one of the ways that we do that in the forestry division is through our Tree Planters Grant program, which actually focuses on planting trees in the parkways in front of people's homes and other public and quasi-public spaces.
Right. So you touch upon, which is exactly why I wanted you to be the person I talked to for today's topic, which is all about something that I always credit to a tree biologist that I've gotten the opportunity to work with a lot in the UK, Dr. Andrew Hirons. He always, he's obsessed with old trees, especially from a biology perspective. They're incredibly interesting. They're not just trees. They're these habitats for like 500 odd other species. And I've learned a lot from him. But one of the things he always tells me is, as we live in this age of these massive tree planting campaigns, right? We want 1 million trees. Well, we're going to plant 20,000 trees. We're going to plant 1 billion trees, all these campaigns. And Dr. Hirons always says to me, you know, don't tell me how many trees you're planting today. Tell me how many trees are still there after 20 years. That's the real metric that I'm interested in. And that, you know, that's an interesting conversation to have. We can take that in the direction of, as I typically have in the past, okay, let's talk about all the different tools at our disposal, whether that's soil sensors that are going to tell us when to water, whether that's remote sensing that's going to tell us the best places to plant those trees, whether that's finding ways to have people to connect to those trees that so that they become really part of their home and their life and their surroundings. And I think that third part is something that you and the rest of the team at Openlands have a lot of experience with. So how do you go about doing these community greening initiatives in a way that engages the community, that makes it feel like it's their project?
The beauty of the Tree Planters Grant program is that it is entirely a community-driven initiative. Mm-hmm. So I believe the first planting season for the Tree Planters Grant was the fall of 2013, really picking up steam in the spring of 2014, that next planting season. And it has been I'm very, very fortunate. I've been with OpenLands for coming up on 4 years. And I really inherited this fantastic program. As they say, I stand on the shoulders of giants. The director of forestry and the VP of community conservation now. In 2014, we're literally meeting people in their living rooms and saying, you want trees, your neighbors want trees, how are we going to make this happen? And that is the genesis of the program. It started mm-hmm. with people saying, hey, we want trees. You have the connections with the city. You have a 25 plus year relationship with all of these people. You have the ability to get the liability coverage and the permits and all of these things that an average citizen doesn't have the ability to do. Back to that convener of people function that we like to serve is, how can we work together to get this done? And so it is a program that is entirely focused on the community's desires and what does the community want to do. And so the basic way that it works is, somebody hears about the program and there are free trees available for you in your neighborhood, your community. And I say, oh, wow, that's really interesting. What do I have to do? And it is, you apply for the grant, you figure out where the trees will be planted, and then you gather the volunteers to do the planting yourself, and then OpenLands takes care of everything else. So what that typically looks like is, you walk outside your house and you say, oh, there is no tree in the parkway in front of my house. I would like a tree here. Write down that address. And then you talk to your neighbor and you say, hey, I noticed that you also don't have a tree in front of your house. Would you like one? Yes, you would like one. Would you be willing to help, you know, us plant the tree together? Yes, of course. And then it moves that way. And so it is neighbors finding other neighbors who also want a tree. And then we set up a time when we can all come together and plant those trees as neighbors.
And
go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just going to ask, so you have you have them that are doing the actual planting of the tree. How do you get them involved in the maintenance of that tree as well?
So every person who wants a tree, we have a contract. It's not legally binding or anything like that, but we have paperwork that people fill out that says, you know, yes, I live here and plan to live here for quite some time. Yes, I want this tree in front of my house. I understand that trees need water to live, and I agree to water this tree once a week for the next 3 years during the growing season. Yes, I volunteer to come help plant these trees on this day. So it's not just, you know, oh, I heard that this person wants a tree, we're going to plant a tree there without communicating. We have a very deliberate and pretty in-depth communication with the people who actually are requesting these trees. And then we also do things like seasonal maintenance emails. So we have everybody's contact information. Part of that contract is really gathering everybody's contact information so that we can establish a line of communication, so that if they have any questions or concerns about their tree at all, they have a person, they have me, or, you know, our Tree Planters Grant team that they can actually reach out to and talk to a person about their concerns or their
troubleshooting.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, just having a line of communication. And then we send out seasonal maintenance emails, you know, little colorful, cutesy, advice on, winter is coming, make sure that you don't put too much salt on your sidewalk, or spring is coming, make sure that you refresh the mulch and don't volcano mulch and pull it away from your trees. And summer is here, have you got your watering schedule in place? And then even in the summertime, we're setting up systems where we can say, hey, everybody, it hasn't rained in 3 weeks. please make sure that your trees are getting water.
Right.
Our next big project is starting to try and increase engagement around these trees, and try and get some social media happening. I don't know. That's nothing is actually happening. That's all conceptual right now.
Yeah.
But we are trying to figure out ways to increase buy-in around those trees. And then the last thing that I'll say about that is one of the main functions of requiring or requesting that the people come help us plant the trees themselves is we have expert supervision that is planting the trees with them, whether it's our trained tree keepers or one of our registered apprentices or a full-time staff member. They are planting a tree with a, you know, expert or quasi-expert.
Sure.
And so our supervisor is talking to them about, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, this is what will need to be done going forward. So theoretically, every tree that is being planted has hands-on instruction time associated with that tree with the person who is actually adopting it. And that's the ideal situation, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you guys have really been able to do here is a key problem that I think is facing so many nonprofits and municipalities and private landowners around the world, which is just this confusion of ownership, this not understanding of whose responsibility is this. And then often then, of course, on public land ends up falling to the municipality for better or for worse. And I think what you've been able to do here is do due diligence on the one hand, and then also just creating this sense of ownership, not just for the day, not just as the steward for the day, but really enabling this longer term relationship that this one particular person that has a face and that has a name has with that specific tree. And I think that's what we often forget in a lot of these big ambitions, is that we forget that people develop, individuals develop unique relationship with trees. And that's such a powerful tool when it comes to the preservation of existing trees, but that's exactly the kind of relationship that we can also create from the very beginning when that tree is planted. And that I think is super, super powerful. I know some of the listeners might be curious, wow, that sounds incredible. That sounds like they've really figured it out. Do you guys have any statistics on survival rates when planting trees in this way?
We do. At this point, we have a greater than 80% success rate.
That's
so
great.
And that is out of the, we've to date, the program has planted 8,500 trees. And I believe it's actually closer to 90%, but for reporting purposes and all of that stuff that we, you know, when we write grants, because we know that we can achieve an 80% success rate. But it's in reality, it's a little bit closer to 90.
And that's for 1 year or 5 years, or what's the time frame?
That is after 3 years.
3 years.
And then we actually, inventory. Well, it's a little bit interesting. It's hard to say because we do a re-inventory after 3 years and we do a re-inventory after 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now the program is long enough to where we are continuing to keep track of those trees, you know, beyond that 6 year re-inventory. So we have two re-inventory processes that happen.
And is the,
in addition,
I was just going to ask, is the 80% at 3 years, is it also 80% at 6 years? Does it drop a little?
No, it's typically if they make it to 3 years, they're there at 6 years.
Gotcha.
Is what we have seen.
Great. That's incredible. That's what you want.
Yeah, it is. It is really, it's, I think it's impressive, not only because I am with Open Lands, but just in general, that sort of success is not, I don't think it's super duper typical in the community planting programs that have been around, you know, as long as ours have.
No, and I was just going to say, it's hard to say for sure because there's been so little research, like any kind of meta-analysis or systematic review that's been done in terms of those survival rates. I mean, I know in general, I know also the USDA forest, Lara Roman, has done a lot of work on mortality and survival rates of trees in cities, and specifically with, so it is really hard to say, to kind of compare, you know, what do you compare that 80% to? But I think it's, you know, that's the thing. It's like, well, it's not really about comparing it to anyone else, is it? It's about the fact that
right.
Open Lands has been able to develop these community forest stewards that are ensuring this high survival rate. And I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And I'm glad you say, you know, forest stewards. That's another huge thing that the forestry division does, is we have the tree keepers program. And tree keepers is basically our highly trained volunteer corps specifically around urban forestry stewardship and stewarding open lands trees. And I mentioned that they're really involved in the planting project. So basically, the tree keepers course is hosted spring, summer, and fall. Actually, I'm not going to say that. It's at least hosted spring, summer, and fall of every year. And each class is typically about 50 people. And it is a month long course, two classes a week. So it's, you know, each class is 3 hours long. So it is a very in-depth training.
That's accessible just to residents of Chicago or of the surrounding area? Because I assume you're training to be tree keepers in that area, or could anyone join?
Right. No, it is Chicago region. We focus on the city of Chicago. We do have several suburban chapters that are being formed. And if there is a suburban municipality that's interested in forming a tree keepers chapter, we will work with them to make that happen. But
you can replicate
The reason that we focus on Chicago is because we have the Tree Keepers program is almost, I think this will be their 30th anniversary coming up.
Wow.
It is a longstanding program with, you know, with a 25 year plus relationship with the city of Chicago. And the crux of that whole situation is the city of Chicago allows certified tree keepers to do work on public land. Pardon me, because they know that they have been trained to an open land standard. They know that we have really put time and resources into making sure that these folks just aren't out there willy-nilly doing whatever they want tree-wise. It is a way for citizens of the region to get involved with maintaining the trees in their community above board. Sure. So when you are a certified tree keeper, if you see a need for street tree pruning in your neighborhood, you can come to us and we will get you those permits above board from the city. And then we organize a tree keeper work day and get that work done. So our tree keepers prune thousands of trees every year. They have tree walks and engagement events. They do mulching days. They do tons and tons of stuff. And the program, the training is everything from how to properly plant a tree to prune a tree to how to engage with elected officials. So it's a really comprehensive program. And that it is. And it's all about, as you say, increasing stewardship of the urban forest, which I think is another reason why the Tree Planters Grant is so successful, is because we have this volunteer corps that we can really lean on for assistance on the planting day, but then follow up maintenance for all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. And again, it's programs like that, I think, that give people, residents overall, but also specifically the people that want to get more involved with trees and tree planting and tree growing within cities, there's a real kind of prestige almost to being part of an organization, being part of a community organization like that, and getting to call yourself a tree keeper, I can imagine is something that really resonates with a lot of people.
Yeah, and this is my tree keeper badge. I am tree keeper 1535. And it's got our logo, it's got your name, and it's got your tree keeper number on there. And it's got your, you know, the tree keeper bill of rights on the back, basically saying that I am a tree keeper. I am certified and trained. I am qualified to be doing this work that I'm doing. And whether that's inventory or pruning street trees, pruning in a park, whatever the activity that the tree keeper is doing, is they have been trained and certified and they are empowered and entitled to be there because they have put the time in to become certified.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it sounds, I'm really excited about this because it sounds like a program that many cities can replicate in a way that makes sense for them in their own local environments as well. Hey everybody, thanks again to this season's sponsor, Planet Geo. Planet Geo has a suite of software and services all designed to shift the urban forestry conversation from hypothetical to reality. See the link in the show notes to learn more. And now, back to the show. And I'm Absolutely. Curious, you touched upon it a little bit about wanting to explore ways to amplify citizen engagement through social media. Speak about that a little bit more, about what could this, I know it's just conceptual now, but what would be the dream for either using social media or perhaps any other kind of technologies to kind of further amplify the citizen engagement work in the future?
What we really want to know is, how are people staying connected with their tree? So what, you know, what place does that tree have in their family? What, you know, I don't know. It is very much so conceptual, but we just want people to be able to interact with us around their tree and kind of trying to figure out, you know, show us your donuts or what, you know, like whatever, like a show us your mulch donut or show it, like whatever. I don't know. We are very much so in the early stages of that, conceptualization, but it kind of goes back to the I'm sure, and I think you may have even had a guest on your pod about the email addresses for Melbourne, Australia.
Yes, yeah, Yvonne Lynch. Yeah, she assigned the ID number of the tree. Each tree was via those assigned an individual email address that they originally were like, this is a great way to keep track of individual trees and issues or complaints associated with individual trees. And then people just started using it to en masse write love letters to these trees.
Right. And that sort of engagement is so beautiful and so human and so, like you said, unexpected, where we really just want to try and figure out a mechanism for, or an avenue for people to have that sort of opportunity to engage with their, you know, the nature where they live, and right. our trees in particular, because we want to know if somebody loves our tree like that. We want to know. If somebody hates our tree, we want to know. I don't think that happens, because again, we don't give a tree to anybody that doesn't ask for one. Mm-hmm. But just trying to, and it goes back to what I was saying about the maintenance email, just making sure that people know that there is somebody on the other end that cares very deeply and truly about the tree that they have.
Right.
And just providing an avenue to talk about that is really important to us. And so that's kind of what we're getting at with social media stuff. But maybe I can follow up with that later.
Well, and what about the idea of getting one of the actual trees on social media? I don't know if you came across an episode that I did with Tim Rademacher, who basically he hooked up a tree in the middle of Harvard Forest in Peterson, Massachusetts, to a bunch of tree sensors. And that tree, Whitney, the witness tree, at a witness tree on Twitter, has now amassed over 10,000 followers. And she tweets about her, you know, her daily life. And in fact, me and Dr. Andrew Hirons, who I mentioned earlier, were so inspired by this. We wanted to replicate this idea, but then for an urban tree, and also with a number of soil sensors, because soil, of course, I don't have to explain this to you, Tom, but, and for many of the listeners out there, but soil is this massively, you know, undervalued resource when it comes to ensuring the establishment of urban trees. And so now we launched a little over a year ago, Bowie the Birch, at Bowie the Birch on Twitter, who is tweeting from his hometown of Liverpool in England about his daily musings as an urban tree in Liverpool and all of the different, you know, uniquely urban issues that Bowie faces that Whitney might not be able to face, or might not face, in the middle of Harvard Forest. And I know it's a broader dream of Dr. Tim Rademacher's and mine as well, to set up this network of tweeting trees around the world. And that this beautiful concept. Imagine that every city had a tweeting tree that served as the mascot, really, the tree mayor of that city's trees. I think it would be such an incredible way to not only increase citizen engagement and awareness, but also give trees a voice, you know, like a digital Lorax that's tweeting rather than speaking for the trees.
I think that is a really fun and fantastic and beautiful idea. It's like city tree, country tree.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's so neat. I really love that idea. I'm over here taking notes, so I will certainly be talking to some folks about that idea.
Yeah, well, follow up about it if you'd like to, because it's something that we've been doing a lot of work on over the last year, because it's something that, as it was the originally, I mean, when Tim's Tweeting Tree, Whitney came out, that was heavily inspired by a European research project. And both that, which had, I think, 21 trees in it, as well as Tim's, were mostly academic pursuits. And now with Bowie, we're trying to see if we can really scale this up to make this almost like a product, like a sensor array, like a product that, whether it's a municipality or a nonprofit or a hospital or a botanical garden or arboretum, can just purchase, install, and boom, have their tweeting tree up and live, you know, in a couple of days. Like that would be the dream, to just have this be a lot more accessible and scalable. So yeah, but that's a side tangent. I've got to ask, so you guys have had incredible success with this program, which I think is really exciting to a lot of listeners, because I think it can be replicated in so many different forms and fashions in cities around the world. It's been really successful, but I'm sure it hasn't been without its challenges. What would you say is, you know, the top one challenge or dare I say failure that has happened that you've had to address head on?
I've spent some time thinking about this question, because and I don't want to say I've never had any failures. The program overall was a very well-built machine by the time that I got here. And so the success of the program itself, the Tree Planters Grant Program, it's just been really about refining processes and sort of doing that machine building associated with a program like this, where you just have to find a process that works, document it, and move forward and try and improve on that. And everybody mm-hmm. brings their own little spin on there when they arrive. But what I was thinking about associated with, you know, a failure or a lesson learned actually has to do with the community engagement aspect of tree plantings. Not every tree that OpenLands plants is associated with a Tree Planters Grant. There is occasions where we have to find places with a lot of available planting space so that we can plant with our, we have a arborist registered apprenticeship. We're the only registered apprenticeship for arboriculture in the state of Illinois. Mm-hmm. And one of, I think there's only like five in the country. So we have to have places where we can train our apprentices. And so sometimes we just have to find sites to plant trees, and that it works out really well because we have a longstanding relationship with Chicago Park District. The Park District has funding to plant and maintain trees from the sidewalk in. From the sidewalk out, so the parkway, they are unable to touch, because that is land that is managed by the Bureau of Forestry. And the way that the system in Chicago is currently set up is that the Bureau of Forestry doesn't plant trees for anything without a request. So obviously, you know, the park can't request trees for its own parkway. So a lot of times we have this great relationship with the Parks Department, where they would say, hey, we could really use some trees at this park. Can you plant trees on the parkway here? Because we can't. And we will, of course, oblige. And so that's where most of our non-TPG tree planting comes from, is the parks will reach out and say, we could use trees at this park. And one of those parks that we planted at is called Morganfield Park. It's like 118th and Morgan Street on the far south side of Chicago. And we planted up the parkways around this park, and we used it as a training opportunity for our crew and also actually for our certified tree keepers. It was their planting practical, so that they could physically plant a tree and we could sign off that they were, you know, able to lead planting groups and all of that stuff.
Right.
And while we were there, and those planting sites are maintained by Openlands. We water them weekly. We mulch them twice a year. We prune. We do all of that stuff. So it's not like we're not planting them and forgetting about them. We do maintain them for the next 6 years. But when we were at this planting, a car pulled up next to the park, and there were these two guys in there, and they're about my age, you know, relatively young for the neighborhood. And they were like, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" I was like, "Oh, we're planting trees. Do you want to come help?" And they're like, "No, that's okay. But are you doing like a park revitalization or what's going on here?" And I was like, "No, we're just, you know, we're a tree planting organization and we're going to plant and maintain these trees for a while." And they were like, "Oh, well, can you get our basketball nets back?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Well, they came and they took our basketball nets away because they didn't want people gathering at the park." And it was just, and I don't, you know, I will not make any sort of commentary on the neighborhood or the parks department or the police department or any of that, because I don't know what the reasons are. I don't know why those nets were taken away, but that was such a stop and think moment to me, because that is the need and the concern of the neighborhood, is that park is beloved and utilized, and it's an important place where the neighborhood goes to recreate. And all I could see was the blank parkways. So I think that has been, and that is something that I think about all the time, is what is the community's need for this space? What do they use it for? What do they want to use it for? And how, who do you ask? How do you make contact and figure out what those needs actually are? And we certainly don't have the answer, but one of the answers that I've been able to come up with is being physically present. Not a sign that says Openlands provided these trees, you know, not a yearly visit. We water these trees every single week. We are out there. We have high vis. We've got our logo all over the place. We've got logos on our trucks. We are physically there, you know, we're physically there planting the trees. We are there so that eventually the surrounding neighbors, you know, build up this comfort level, just because they've seen us so often, that they will come up and say something to us, or they will come make a request, or they will say, you know, "Hey, we love the new trees. That tree over there really, really needs to be trimmed out of the way because it makes me nervous or whatever. Can you help us with that?" And more often than not, we do. So I think the my lesson learned on that is making sure that you are physically available to hear the needs of the community and actively trying, excuse me, to figure out what those needs are.
Yeah, that's such a a practical useful lesson, I think. And honestly, I think it's something, and I applaud you for saying it, because I don't think it's something that a lot of people want to necessarily hear, right? Because it takes time and it takes resources and money and years and years and years of investment to have people, right? You can't just have Tom at every planting on every day of the week. So it takes years and years of investing and building up the community of tree keepers and tree stewards and having people that you can trust doing that work, that are not just doing the work of watering trees, but that are actual real spokespersons for people, for not only the trees, but also for the organization that you represent and what you do. So I think that's, I applaud you for saying it, because I don't think it's something that people always want to hear, but it is something that works clearly. And I think the story that you illustrate highlights so perfectly that I think a lot of green-minded professionals forget a lot of the time, right? We see an open grass field and we think, wow, beautiful campus, ripe for opportunity. And we forget what it might otherwise be used for.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Christine Carmichael is one of my one of the people that I look up to, and you know, try and emulate her work, and really, you know, try and take guidance from that school of thought around deliberate, meaningful community engagement specifically around trees. And the work that she did in Detroit, I think, was really, really important, you know, showing why people may not want trees, or why there is a distrust for tree planting programs and tree planting organizations. And I think one of the things,
and maybe just very quickly, just for the listeners, that was research that she did, which was really instigated by the fact that a local nonprofit in Detroit was so confused because they were trying to do a tree planting campaign in certain neighborhoods in Detroit. And over a quarter of residents had submitted something called a no tree request. I mean, it's the opposite of what Tom is describing here. It's a request that says, no, do not plant a tree in front of my house. And they were absolutely clueless as to why that happened. And Christine really went into great detail into many of the very logical reasons why residents didn't want those trees. And in fact, whether that was, well, we had to move because these roots grew into my sewer system and I had to move my house and it's the tree's fault. And that was an 8-year-old saying that, very traumatic event for an 8-year-old has to move house because of a tree root. Or interestingly enough, she found that a lot of the issues, of course, were to do with the fact that, yeah, a lot of, you know, maybe Detroit did a lot of planting, but not a lot of maintenance, and it fell onto the residents to do the maintenance, and they were tired of having to take care of old, sometimes sick and often dangerous trees that then became their responsibility. They didn't have the time or the money to resource to deal with it. But I think one of the most interesting findings was that a lot of people actually that submitted no tree requests did want a tree. They just didn't want the tree that the nonprofit was offering, which was big canopied, you know, big crown trees that would provide a lot of shade to combat, you know, heat and all these other events. And they were like, well, we're interested in trees. We just were thinking more ornamental trees or perhaps fruit trees that we could be able to harvest from. So there's, I'll let you get back to what you wanted to say, but just for the listeners, so they have an idea of just how groundbreaking that study was.
Absolutely. And it's and the other thing that I appreciate about Dr. Carmichael is she has made herself accessible to the community of tree planting folks, tree people who are doing that sort of community-based tree planting stuff. She has made herself extremely accessible to that. But one of the main takeaways that I have come away with from Dr. Carmichael is that not every place that doesn't have trees is lacking. So just because there is not a tree doesn't mean that there needs to be a tree there. And like you were talking about looking at the blank field and seeing the future forest that could be there. The neighbors look at that blank field and they see the spot where their kids play soccer. They see the place where their family has had an annual barbecue every year for the past 60 years. They see, you know, field day at the adjacent school. And that goes for any place that doesn't have a tree there. There may be a very valid and important reason why there isn't a tree there. And it is your prerogative, it is the tree planter's job to make sure that you are not throwing a wrench in the community's idea of that space. And the other thing that you said that I wanted to touch on is taking the time to build the capacity to do the work that you are trying to do. That is something that OpenLands has been very deliberate about over the past couple of years. So we have defined, in 2018, we defined a priority planting area based off of some really great work that a lot of Chicago Regional Trees Initiative is one of the, OpenLands is a founding member of CRTI. They're based out of the Morton Arboretum. They do a ton of really fantastic work around trees in the Chicago region, and including a region-wide urban tree cover or urban tree canopy study, taking a look at where there is and is not tree canopy in the region. And using that information, we were able to look at the city of Chicago and say, this is an area that we think we can make really good inroads and has a genuine need for trees and has less trees than the rest of the city. And the other genesis of that was, you know, we don't get any tree planters grant requests. Like if you look at a map of our tree planters grants, there was this gaping hole on the southwest side of Chicago, basically the 10 community areas surrounding Midway Airport, and just that southwest side of Chicago, And one of the things that we kind of came up with trying to figure out why isn't anybody asking for trees here, that part of the city has one of the largest Spanish-speaking populations outside of Los Angeles. It is the largest Spanish-speaking population outside of Los Angeles in the United States. And nobody had asked them if they wanted trees in their native tongue. And there was nobody on staff that could do that. And so that's one of the things that we, you know, defining the priority area, we have said, we are going to give priority to any project that comes up in this area. And beyond that, we are going to take a step outside of the normal tree planters grant process where people ask us for trees. And we are going to start finding community organizations that we can work with and say, hey, who do you know that wants trees? Or how can tree planting fit in with your the existing goals of your organization? And can we use your communication network to try and get out that word about planting trees in the community? And so we have done a lot of stuff from developing bilingual resources in Spanish and English, working with organizations to have bilingual programming or just plain old Spanish language programming, identifying community members that we can give direct support to. We are stipending community members that are able to go around and ask their neighbors in their own native language if they would like trees. And then something that is huge and really important that happened recently is we were able to hire another program coordinator specifically focused on the Tree Planters Grant that is a native Spanish speaker. And so he has been really instrumental as far as putting that next level of depth onto the relationships that we have been working on forming in our priority area. And all of that is to say, you know, that is building capacity to reach our specific goal of increasing tree planting and stewardship in a portion of the city that has had a lack of tree planting and stewardship. And it's not that, you know, it's trees have always been available there from the city of Chicago. They've always been available there for open lands. And we know that there are tree lovers in every corner of the world. It's just nobody has said, hey, are you aware that you can get a tree from the city or from open lands and that you can plant it with your neighbors and that we can have this fantastic community event and change the face of your neighborhood for decades? That has never been expressed in a way that's accessible to people. And I think one of my mantras is walk the walk. And I think that is a really important aspect of the work that we do is we are trying desperately to actually walk that walk. We are trying to put our money where our mouth is and build the capacity in the areas that need to be built up.
No, truly, really inspiring message and so important because I think it's something that, again, in this age of big policies and big ambitions and this, I don't want to open a whole other can of worms, but this whole talk about, you know, trees being these amazing carbon sequesters, it's like, I think we're missing the point of what trees can mean for a community. And you can have all these fantastic organizations that want to make sure that those trees are planted, but if the community buy-in isn't there, if you're not, as I'm going to try to summarize what I've learned, if you're not, the community buy-in isn't there, if you're not physically present on the site regularly, and if you're trying to promote something in a language that the vast majority of people aren't connecting with, well, then how can you possibly think that that is going to succeed? So I have to thank you, Tom, because this has been really filled with a lot of really practical lessons that I think are really useful. I know there's probably people out there that are interested in learning more about the Treekeeper program and the grant and Open Lands as an organization and perhaps you as an individual. So where is the best place for people to connect with you and with Open Lands online?
Openlands.org, openlands.org is our organizational website. You can see all of the great work that we are doing there. We are on LinkedIn, or we are on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Openlands. And personally, you can find me on LinkedIn. I would also love If anybody wanted to email me, it is my name, T. Ebeling, Ebeling, @openlands.org. You can also email treecare@openlands.org if you want to get hold of me. But yeah, I think the thing that I would like to leave you with is another mantra that we have in the forestry division. And there's a saying that came from one of the original tree keepers. Tree keeper Jim was the person that taught the course for years and years and years, who is no longer with us. But Jim would say that trees are what we do, but people are why we do it. So yes, trees are a fantastic, you know, trees are the answer, whatever the solution to all of our issues is. But one of the main reasons why we do the work that we do is increasing community resiliency by bringing people together around a common goal. And for us, that just so happens to be treatment. So if you can get people out working on something physically together with their hands, that is where climate resiliency comes from. That is where community resiliency comes from. All the benefits that trees provide are sort of a happy side effect of that connection of people around nature where they currently live.
I couldn't agree more. And I will end the show by asking you a question that I ask all of my guests who come on the show. And that is, what does the Internet of Nature mean to you?
The Internet of Nature to me means two things. First of all, the connectivity of everything. So just like the internet is, you know, the great even playing field, the way that we stay connected with people all over the world, I think that the Internet of Nature is the way that we can and should communicate with everything surrounding us. And the relationships that can be formed when you take the time to sort of commune with the nature in your own front yard or your backyard. The other thing that the Internet of Nature means to me is sort of the metaphor for, I think we are getting ready to see an unbelievable technological revolution happening around nature and access to nature and green infrastructure and building nature and green space where people are. I think like the internet was sort of the great technological revolution of our generation's lifetime. I think the next technological revolution will happen surrounding, you know, the ex-urban interface, you know, nature and urban interface and green infrastructure technology and the societal changes that will come from that revolution.
Well, cheers to that. That's definitely a revolution I want to be a part of.
Amen.
Thank you, Tom, for coming on.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Internet of Nature podcast. Want to learn more about the Internet of Nature? Subscribe to my newsletter at nadinachala.com. I'm looking forward to bringing you another great guest next week. As always, remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review if you learned something new. The best way to support us is to share this episode with a friend or colleague. Season 5 of the Internet of Nature podcast on the future of urban forestry is brought to you by Planet Geo. See you next week.